And welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Nonpareil for Monday, May 24th, 2021. I'm your volunteer reader, Amy B. This is my first time reading the Nonpareil, so bear with me today. Let's take a look at the front page stories. Abraham Lincoln High School Commencement. Seniors celebrate outside the Mid-America Center following the Abraham Lincoln High School commencement on Friday, May 21st. The AL class of 2021 was made up of 321 seniors. Longfellow auction brings in nice total for first grader on chemo. The Longfellow Elementary School family came through for a student being treated for lymphoblastic leukemia, an online auction held May 10th through the 12th to benefit first grader Chelsea Craig, brought in $4,765, according to Haley Hires, library clerk at Longfellow and one of the auction organizers. Organizers, who also included Longfellow Health Associate Kelly Keller, teacher Erin McArdle, and counselor Donette Kremke-Bastian, rounded up 66 items for the auction. That included gift cards, as well as many themed baskets filled with merchandise related to pet care, car care, self-care, salon services, fast food, birdhouses, coffee, ice cream, treats, snacks, summer fun for the kids, and games, with items donated by local businesses and individuals. Our two highest baskets, I believe, were a spa day treat yourself basket, with items donated from a few staff members, and our McDonald's basket donated by McDonald's that had a Lion King character toys, some goodies, and a free kids' meal a week for a year, Hires said. Chelsea was diagnosed on April 2nd and is receiving chemotherapy at Children's Hospital. A bone marrow biopsy taken on May 10th showed that there was no longer leukemia in her bone marrow. However, she faces a long period of what is considered preventative maintenance. She has begun a month of chemo through daily oral chemo supplements after receiving her first treatment via transfusion. Following that, she will undergo several more phases of treatment, including a couple of 8-week cycles and then 12-week cycles until she has completed 2 years of treatment. She is currently not well enough to attend school, but receives instruction remotely. In April, students and staff members sold Tootsie Pops to raise money for her family. On April 30th, they had a car parade past the Craig's house and stopped to give them money raised from their sales, $1,121. Forecast: high winds to impact the area. The Council Bluffs, Omaha area will see high winds from the south, gusting as high as 24 miles per hour at times. By this afternoon, highs will be in the mid-80s, with chances for showers and thunderstorms after 1 p.m., according to the National Weather Service in Valley, Nebraska. Tonight, chances for showers continue, with temps dropping into the 60s. Chances for rain and storms continue throughout the week. The forecast for Council Bluffs, according to the Weather Service, 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms after 1 p.m. today, partly sunny with a high near 84, south wind 6 to 15 miles per hour, with gusts as high as 24 miles per hour. Tonight, a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms after 1 a.m. Mostly cloudy, with a low around 67, south wind 10 to 14 miles per hour, with gusts as high as 22 miles per hour. Tonight, there might be showers and thunderstorms, mainly before 1 a.m., mostly cloudy, with a low around 65. New rainfall amounts between a quarter and half an inch are possible. Law offers adoptees a chance at a copy of an original birth certificate. A new Iowa law will allow adopted adults to procure a copy of their original birth certificate. The law, signed on May 19th by Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, allows an adopted adult whose original birth certificate was substituted with a new certificate after an adoption to apply for and obtain a non-certified copy of the original certificate of birth, which will include biological parent information, the governor's office said in a release. The new law will also allow an entitled person to apply for the adult adoptee's original certificate prior to adoption if the adoptee is deceased, the office said. In addition, the law allows biological parents to file contact preference and medical history forms with the Bureau of Health Statistics in the Iowa Department of Public Health. If completed by biological parents, these forms will be released to an adult adoptee or entitled person upon proper application. The law will immediately apply to those who were born before 1971. Beginning January 1, 2022, anyone over the age of 18 can request the same document, the release said. According to the governor's office, application processing will take approximately 6 weeks. Contact preference forms and medical history forms may already be on file for the biological parents named on the record. If the contact preference forms and medical history forms are on file, the forms will be released to the adult adoptee with a non-certified original birth certificate. Biological parents may choose to release their identity and contact information to the adoptee. They may also choose not to disclose their identity and contact information. For more information or to apply, go to the Iowa Department of Public Health website. We can do better. After flub at Capitol, Nebraskans say state flag should be changed. Jack Sokolik has, to put it lightly, never been a fan of Nebraska's state flag. The seal on a bedsheet design, what flag enthusiasts call an SOB, make Nebraska's banner nearly indistinguishable from 28 other states that have similar flags. That's strike one for many. The state seal that's centered on the flag is fine for a seal, if a little busy for my liking, Sokolik said, even if it seems to forget it's representing the Cornhusker state. A train barrels down the tracks below a mountain range while a steamboat chugs up the Missouri River, meaning the land depicted on the other side is that of Iowa. I personally don't want Iowa on my state's flag, Sokolik said. Strike two. The third strike is the seal's self-proclamation as the Great Seal of the State of Nebraska, which is featured more prominently than the state's motto, Equality Before the Law. It's a big middle finger when it comes to good design, Sokolik said. But Sokolik, a junior at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln from Omaha, majoring in social sciences education, didn't think about how the flag could be better until recently. In 2017, after the flag was unceremoniously hung upside down at the Capitol building for 10 straight days, then-Senator Burke Haar of Omaha suggested Nebraskans submit their own designs. Haar's resolution didn't go anywhere, mirroring the fate of a 2002 call for a task force to re-examine Nebraska's flag after the North American Vexillological Association slotted it 71st of 72 United States and Canadian flags in a 2001 ranking. The attention drawn to the issue inspired Sokolik and others to begin thinking about how the state's flag could be improved upon. To date, more than 50 designs have been uploaded to a vexillology site dedicated to the Nebraska state flag. Dave Ellis, a Nebraska expatriate living in Iowa, said he has long been frustrated by Iowan's flag is more unique and recognizable than that of its neighbor to the west. It drives me insane that their flag is better than ours, said Ellis, a Parks and Recreation director in Cherokee, Iowa. I love my home state, but its flag just isn't anything that stands out. So, like Sokolik, Ellis took a deep dive into vexillology, the study of flags, to begin learning what distinguished good banners from bad ones. Over the next 2 years, and 123 iterations, he began to develop what he calls the goldenrod, a flag steeped in symbolism that sought to adhere to what Ellis said was the most important of the rules for flag designing. "It's simple enough that a second grader can draw it from memory," the Grand Island native said. Unlike the existing blue flag with a yellow seal, the goldenrod features a golden field to represent the state's cornfields, as well as the gold-painted Union Pacific locomotives that cross the state. A single white star symbolizes Nebraska's unicameral form of government, the only of its kind in the country, and the state's decision to reject slavery when it came into the Union as the 37th state. Centered on the same spot as the 37th star on the U.S. flag, the blue border reminds Nebraskans of the Ogallala Aquifer beneath their feet, while a red circle encompassing the star symbolizes the shape of fields irrigated by a center pivot. Finally, a blue bar running horizontally represents Nebraska's role in connecting east to west. Ellis said he understands this design might be too far of a departure from the current state flag, but he believes bolder is better, pointing to bright colors and iconic designs of Colorado's flag. "Flags are a form of art, and you're never going to get 100% agreement on whether art is good or bad," he said. "I do believe bold is what gets people to recognize you." Like Ellis, Sokolik didn't make any headway at first, but immersed himself in the very dorky interest of vexillology. "I think everybody, even if they might not want to admit it, has some affinity to flags and flag designs," Sokolik said. "They are a unique thing in culture, the doorways to a society, and are powerful symbols of a place. Think the palmetto tree and crescent moon of South Dakota's flag, the red sun symbol of the indigenous Zia people on a field of gold that represents New Mexico, or the yellow stars of the Big Dipper and North Star on a field of deep blue that signals Alaska's spot on the globe." Sokolik's design seeks to honor the design of the current flag by maintaining the blue field and golden circle. Instead of the great seal of the state Nebraska, the roundel of his flag is intended to represent a golden train wheel, while the negative spaces of the wheel conjure up an image of a windmill. Surrounding the roundel are eight stars, one each for Nebraska's eight indigenous tribes, as well as for the eight original counties when the state was still a territory. Finally, white and red streamers on one edge call back the French influence over the region and Nebraska's history as part of the Louisiana Territory. Both flag designs are unique and would signal a vast upgrade from the current flag, their creators say, and dispel notions of Nebraska as a flyover state. Ellis has opened up an online shop to sell his flag, as well as stickers and magnets, too, and what he said is an effort to create some buzz for the design. After finishing his design and having a prototype printed, Sokolik has informally gathered signatures both on UNL's campus as well as at community events like the Battle of the Joshes in April to gauge interest. Both amateur vexillologists say they hope Nebraskans will start thinking more about how a new flag could become a powerful tool for how the state presents itself to the rest of the country and the world. "We can do better. We can always do better," Sokolik said. "Change is good," Ellis said. "The current flag is uninspiring, and I want people to see that and call for something better." Louis Central parent concerned about optional mask usage. On the first day of Louis Central Community School District's policy of considering masks optional, a parent spoke up at a Board of Education meeting to express her concerns. During the public participation period near the beginning of the meeting, April Shepherd gave an emotional response to the school district's sudden and unexpected decision to declare masks optional. "We are on a downward trend, and that's a good thing," she said. "I get that there's not any fear that you guys have had from contact tracing within the school, but I would believe that a big part of that is because of masking." Shepherd said that she hadn't seen the email sent out on Sunday by the district, and wasn't initially aware of the change in policy. Although I appreciate the email, I believe the decision and the delivery was way off the mark, she said. If school was going to be out on Monday or any day of the week, I would get an email, a text, and a phone call. So today, my 9-year-old came home and informed me that she didn't wear her mask all day because her teacher told her it was optional, Shepherd said. Had I been aware that that was the case, optional, I would have been sure to instruct her that it was not an option for her. Any parent can choose to have their child wear a mask, an updated guidance distributed Friday by the Iowa Department of Public Health noted. While we acknowledge that some parents may want their child to continue to wear a cloth face mask covering for reasons that make sense for their family or the child's individual health condition, we urge schools and child care settings to provide parents and students with the option to make their own decision about mask usage, the update stated. But Shepherd felt she needed to take more drastic measures. More time would have been appreciated because tomorrow I have to find out what my kids can do to finish remote learning from home, she said. I'm high risk, Shepherd said. My daughter can't get vaccinated yet. I get that kids don't get sick very often from it. I get that there's only been 300 or 400 child deaths from it, but I don't want my kid to be the next one, and I don't want her to get it, be asymptomatic, and give it to me, and then they're without a mother, potentially. We weren't given notice on this, she continued. I have to hope that I can still have a job, because I don't have a job that I can do from home. So I put in for a leave of absence immediately, without any upfront kind of warning to my employer, and hope that I have a job when I come back. Lewis Central was one of many school districts that changed its COVID-19 protocols because of updated guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Iowa Department of Public Health, though some made smaller changes. Superintendent Eric Nost considered Friday's updated guidelines from IDPH, advice from Pottawatomie County Public Health, and conversations with board members before deciding to drop the mask requirement, he told the Nonpareil on Monday. I communicated with our local public health department, Pottawatomie County, this weekend in order to fully understand their recommendations pertaining to what IDPH released on Friday, he said in a message sent to Lewis Central families on Sunday. It was clarified for me that they do concur that now is an appropriate time to make face coverings optional in schools. In the message, Nost still promoted the voluntary use of masks. As your superintendent, I still highly encourage the utilization of face coverings, he said. I will most likely choose to continue wearing a mask, especially when indoors, and specifically around large groups. While there will not be a mandated requirement, everyone is welcome and encouraged to do the same. Nost followed up with Shepherd after the meeting and said he understands her frustrations and concerns. I talked with Mrs. Shepherd later last evening, and she was extremely kind, he said. She's just not in agreement with the decision that came down from IDPH, and she is concerned with the general population not utilizing masks. Yes, we still have students, parents, and staff members who are choosing to continue utilizing masks. We have stated that it is still encouraged, but at this point, it is still parent or teacher choice. Murphy, lawmakers run roughshod over local control. A frequent thought among those who can be skeptical about the true intentions of politicians is that the only political party that truly cares about government spending, debts, and deficits is the party that is out of power. Given the Iowa legislature's recent history, it appears local control suffers from a similar ideological malleability. In other words, Iowa state lawmakers think local control is great until they are in control and another government body is doing something they don't like. For recent evidence, look no further than the 2021 session of the Iowa legislature. With Republicans in complete command of the state lawmaking process, local control was an oak leaf in a tornado, as state lawmakers enacted new mandates that limited the governing options of local school boards, election officials, county supervisors, and city councils and mayors. A bill that was passed in the 11th hour and signed into law on the 12th prohibits local governments from enacting public face mask requirements that exceed the state's requirement of any. So if the COVID-19 pandemic flares up again in any corner of the state, those communities will not be allowed to enact face mask requirements unless the state has one. School districts are similarly handcuffed. A few weeks ago, a school experienced a significant outbreak with hundreds of cases. If that happens again anywhere in Iowa, that district will not be able to install a face mask requirement to help slow the virus spread. Neither can schools manage their student population in order to maintain diversity and avoid leaving at-risk students behind. State lawmakers removed that authority this session. City councils no longer are able to ban discrimination by landlords, since state lawmakers give landlords the authority to reject vouchers from a federal low-income housing program. Sweeping legislation that made myriad of changes to how Iowa's elections are conducted contained several ways to chip away at local control. Under the new law, local election officials are permitted just one drop box per county, regardless of population. For ballots cast early, they must meet more stringent criteria before creating satellite early voting locations, and they are prohibited from sending absentee ballot request forms to voters unless the voter asks. That doesn't even include the fact that the new law also makes it a felony if county auditors violate certain state election laws. Even private business is not immune. With conservatives roiled over social media companies banning users that post false information about the 2020 presidential election, Republican state lawmakers responded this year by passing legislation to disqualify businesses for straight grants or incentives if they violate an individual's free speech. Nor can most businesses require proof of vaccination for their customers or employees, thanks to a new Iowa state law. This is not a new phenomenon. Perhaps the most flagrant example came in 2017 when the Republican-controlled legislature and then Governor Terry Branstad, a Republican, banned cities and counties from creating a minimum wage that exceeds the state's. Just like political parties spend like a Kardashian while in the majority, then suddenly find the purse strings while in the minority, local control, for the moment at least, seems like a guiding star that is only visible to politicians in the minority party, engulfed by the bright light of political power once in the majority. Local contractors sue City of Council Bluffs and Mayor for gender discrimination. Lawsuit refers to harassment charge filed against city building official. A Council Bluffs entrepreneur and contractor has filed a lawsuit against the City of Council Bluffs and Mayor Matt Walsh, alleging gender discrimination and denial of equal rights. Tamara Bruno of Bruno Contracting alleges her business has been affected because of an inability to work within a city building official with code, permit, and inspections expertise related to ensuring a development complies with city building rules. Steve Carmichael is the chief building official for the city. In October 2019, Carmichael pled guilty to a harassment charge related in his conduct in communicating with Bruno. As part of the plea, Carmichael was barred with having contact with Bruno for 5 years. The lawsuit alleges there is not a comparable subject matter expert on city staff to assist Bruno with the kind of work she undertakes. It also alleges Carmichael should have been removed from his position for violating the city's human resource policies. City officials said accommodations have been made to assist Bruno without Carmichael's involvement. Walsh said Carmichael was disciplined for his actions. Bruno and her attorneys with Newkirk Zwagerman of Des Moines, filed the lawsuit on Friday. The city has not filed its response yet. The issue is that Carmichael, in practical terms, is the person with the subject matter expertise to work on complex issues, said attorney Thomas Bullock with Newkirk Zwagerman. Ms. Bruno works on major projects. The lawsuit includes an allegation that among the economic opportunities that Bruno has been forced to forego because of Carmichael's legal inability to communicate with her is the construction of a multi-million dollar manufacturing facility that she would otherwise have supervised the construction of. Bruno launched her construction company in 2008. According to the lawsuit, her work primarily focuses on federal contracts, which are regulated locally. According to the lawsuit, in 2015, Bruno met Carmichael when he inspected a property she'd recently purchased. Carmichael suggested after the initial meeting that the two should meet again to discuss the construction industry in Council Bluffs. When Bruno sent a text message about meeting, Carmichael responded, "I'm game, dear." He subsequently text messaged, "We are rapidly losing time for our Christmas beer under the mistletoe, so maybe next week we can have a cold one." Bruno did not respond to either of the messages because of the unwelcome romantic element, the court filing stated. The lawsuit said Bruno avoided contact with Carmichael in the ensuing years. Bullock noted that Bruno worked on a variety of projects in that time, including federal projects and a clothing line, and in the interim, she didn't happen to have any building projects in the city of Council Bluffs that would have involved working with Carmichael. It's one of those things where it's not like she's always doing that work in the city, but always keeping an eye out for those opportunities, Bullock said. A 2019 Nonpareil story noted Bruno has completed numerous contracts ranging in value from $800 to nearly $5 million for a client list that includes the City of Omaha, the United States Forest Service, the Department of Veteran Affairs, Southwest Iowa Planning Council, and the United States Coast Guard. According to the lawsuit, around August 2019, Carmichael approached Bruno at Home Depot, and the pair engaged in a brief small talk. Shortly thereafter, Carmichael sent Bruno a photo of a nude man whose face was not visible, but whose, expletive deleted, was prominently exposed via text message, the lawsuit said. Bruno contacted the Pottawatomie County Sheriff's Office, which investigated the matter. On October 2, 2019, a sheriff's deputy told Carmichael not to contact Bruno. On that same day, Carmichael sent Bruno a thumbs-up text message. The lawsuit alleges that the message was intended to further harass and intimidate Bruno. The sheriff's office cited Carmichael, and he pled guilty, paying a $100 fine, in addition to accepting the no-contact order. The lawsuit lists a number of human resources policies Council Bluffs are required to follow that Carmichael had reportedly violating, including employees shall not harass, discriminate, or retaliate against any employee or citizen. This includes engaging in any form of sexual or discriminatory harassment. The lawsuit alleges that Walsh chose not to enforce the personnel policies despite Carmichael's violations and kept him on the job. In an interview with the Nonpareil, Walsh said he was unable to discuss much of the suit because of its pending litigation, but said the employee's behavior has been addressed by the city. Council Bluffs City Attorney Dick Wade said he couldn't comment on personnel matters when asked if Carmichael violated the city's human resources policies. Asked why the city decided to keep Carmichael on staff, Wade said he couldn't comment. Asked about the human resources policy in general and the threshold for a firing, Wade said it depends on the situation, the past history of the employee involved. There's no black or white answer. The lawsuit alleges that Walsh attempted to minimize Carmichael's actions. In an October 2, 2019 email to City Councilman Mike Wolf and then council members Nate Watson and Sharon White, Walsh said the harassment charge stemmed from Carmichael sending a crotch picture to a local female contractor. Steve's Facebook Messenger account had a few exchanges of flirty banter between parties. The lawsuit said the exchanges were not flirty and that Bruno had only messaged Carmichael via Facebook once regarding meeting to discuss the industry. She never responded to Carmichael's subsequent messages. The lawsuit alleges Walsh's email to the council members was intended to mislead them about the nature of Carmichael's conduct, while also taking issue with a description of the nude photo as a crotch picture. In an email response to Walsh, which was provided to the nonpareil by Newkirk Zwagerman, White wrote, "I am so disappointed in Steve. Even if it was mutual, and I'm not saying that it was, how stupid can you be to send something like that and think it's not going to get you in trouble?" The lawsuit also alleges Walsh minimized the severity of Carmichael's conduct in an email to the chief building official on November 8, 2019. "While it is my belief that this situation is your personal business, on your own personal time, and therefore doesn't involve the city or your job with the city, I also have an obligation to the taxpayers to confirm my belief. I can't, in good conscience, open the city to the potential for a civil lawsuit if my beliefs of the facts weren't inaccurate," Walsh said in the email per the lawsuit and a copy of the email obtained by the nonpareil. "Therefore, I asked City Attorney Dick Wade if Sarah from Legal could confirm the circumstances surrounding the incident, including speaking to Bruno, so we could nail down her testimony before she gets an opportunity to be coached by an attorney. If your version is accurate, then we can put this all behind us, and if the city does get sued, then we can show a judge that we didn't just brush things under the rug. We actually did our due diligence." Walsh's email came in response to an email from Carmichael, who said he thought, "Somehow this issue was resolved when you, John Finnegan, and I discussed this. I offered to tender my resignation then and was under the assumption that you both felt it was not a city matter. Finnegan was at one time head of the city's human resources department. He left the city on May 1st after not working for at least more than a month. City officials at the time declined to discuss the details of Finnegan's departure, citing personnel and issues. Essentially, they're making issues for him to justify not taking any action," Bullock said. "It's just another case, and we see these cases all the time, where it's about protecting a guy, having that desire to protect this guy's career over the woman's career. It's biased prioritizing. The charges in the lawsuit are gender discrimination and retaliation, denial of services, and harassment based on sex, and denial of equal rights in violation of Article 1 of the Iowa Constitution. The lawsuit also said that the Iowa Civil Rights Commission issued a right to sue letter regarding the matter." Wade told the nonpareil, "Essentially, we've made it so that Bruno would not have to have contact with Steve directly, and that she could conduct her business in different locations within City Hall. Asked if there are employees with comparable expertise, Wade said, "Yes, we have a number of building officials that would be able to respond to questions she might have." Bullock disagreed. "There isn't anybody who has comparable subject matter expertise," Bullock said, noting Bruno worked with a permit clerk and members of the Community Development Department who do not have building code and construction code expertise. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Stanley Byers, 1938 to 2021, born January 25, 1938, died May 11th. Stanley J. Stan Byers, age 83, passed away May 11th, 2021. Stan was born January 25th, 1938, in Omaha, Nebraska. He graduated from Omaha North High School. Stan was into sports most of his life, from Robert's Dairy Little League through his high school years, participating in basketball, track, and football, where he was quarterback for the 1956 Nebraska State Championship Viking team. In 1957, Stan qualified for the state finals as a hurdler. Throughout his athletic ventures, Stan played with injuries. A broken nose or arm never stopped him from competing. Following high school, he attended Doan University, where more severe injuries ended his participation in contact sports. Stan worked as a carpenter and at Western Electric as a line manufacturing supervisor. He attended First Congregational Church and was a lifetime member of the Masonic Lodge. Stan's hobbies were fishing, golf, and carving decoys. He loved Nebraska football, but his favorite pastime was attending athletic events at Abraham Lincoln High School and spending time with family and friends. Stan is survived by his daughter Barbara Byers and other children and grandchildren. Stan will be remembered for his contagious personality and knowing all the answers to Trivial Pursuit and his love of telling jokes. A memorial service is pending and will be held at a later date. Kenneth L. Clark, Sr., age 84, of Council Bluffs, passed away May 16 at the Griswold, Iowa Care Center. Ken was born August 29, 1936, in Missouri Valley, Iowa, to the late Pearl and Velma Real Clark. He married Alma Irene Tiedemann on January 25, 1958. They were blessed with four children. Ken retired from Charles Schneider Furniture. He was also a mechanic and did auto body repair. In addition to his parents, Ken was preceded in death by his wife. Visitation with the family will be Thursday from 5 to 7 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral service Friday 11 a.m. at the funeral home. Interment in Cedar Long Cemetery with a lunch following at Walnut Hill Reception Center, 1350 East Pierce Street. Memorials are suggested to the Alzheimer's Association. Kevin K. Corum, age 57, of Council Bluff, passed away May 15th at his home. Kevin was born July 5, 1963, in Council Bluffs, to Kenneth and Joan Cooksey Corum. He graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School in 1981. Kevin worked at Griffin Pipe for 23 years and was currently working for CenturyLink as a customer service rep. He married Laura Shepherd on June 1, 2012. Kevin will be cremated and a celebration of life service will be held at a later date. Terry Danielson, age 70, passed away peacefully at Florence Home Healthcare on May 13th. He was born February 4th, 1951, to the late Alfred and Helen Armstrong Danielson in Council Bluffs. Terry graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School and proudly served his country in the United States Air Force. Donald Ebert, age 88, passed away May 17th. He was born in Westphalia, Iowa, on September 13th to the late John and Valeria Schmitz Ebert. Donald proudly served his country in the United States Army. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by his wife. A graveside service with military honors are at 10 a.m. at the St. Boniface Catholic Church Cemetery in Westphalia, Iowa, on Wednesday, May 19th, 2021. Charles Sharp, age 74, of Council Bluffs, passed away at home on December 4th, 2020. He was born in Chicago, Illinois, on May 31st, 1946, to the late Bernice Sabonis and Charles W. Sharp. Chuck graduated from Mendel Catholic High School in Chicago and UNO. He proudly served in the U.S. Air Force, 1966 to 1969, at AFA OFUT Air Force Base. He worked as a computer programmer, bus driver, and commercial truck driver, retiring in 2009. Chuck volunteered at the Henry Dorley Zoo as a steam train engineer for 20 years. Chuck was a longtime member of the CB Rifle and Pistol Club and the NRA. Visitation and celebration of Chuck's life and his first heavenly birthday will be held at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park from 5 to 8 p.m. Wednesday, May 26th. Burial will be at 2 p.m. at the Omaha National Cemetery on Friday, May 28th. Casual attire suggested, patriotic, even better. Memorials will be directed by the family. And that concludes today's obituaries. Turning now to some opinions. Tony Bereldi of Council Bluffs writes, "To the members of the Charles E. Lakin YMCA Advisory Board, we would like to invite you to hear the thoughts of our committee members. We have reserved a meeting room at the Council Bluffs Public Library from 7 to 9 p.m. Monday, that's today. While we have heard that you have been advised not to directly comment on the Bond Street issue, we request that you attend to listen to our presentation. Please RSVP by calling 712-322-2501. Thank you." This next letter is by Lee Hazer of Council Bluffs. She writes, "Ethan Nordine is among the more than 400 people who have been charged for their roles in the deadly assault on the Capitol on January 6th. Part of the evidence introduced by the government were texts recovered by his cell phone. Prosecutors say Nordine, along with other Proud Boys, planned to push through police barricades and force themselves inside the building that day. Nordine, the self-described sergeant of arms of the Proud Boys Seattle chapter, is facing several charges, including conspiracy, obstruction of an official proceeding, and aiding and abetting. Prosecutors included the anti-Trump diatribe in which Nordine seemed to acknowledge that he and others are facing criminal charges because they followed Trump's lead. I've followed this guy for 4 years and given everything and lost it all. Yes, he woke us up, but he led us to believe some great justice was upon us, and it never happened," Nordine wrote on January 20th, after Proud Boys members were charged. "Now I've got some of my good friends and myself facing jail time because we followed this guy's lead and never questioned it. We are now and always have been on our own. So glad he was able to pardon a bunch of degenerates on his last move and, expletive delete us, on his way out," Nordine said in an expletive-laden message about the former president. "Trump, you left us on the battlefield, bloody and alone." Nordine is one of several members of the extremist group with ties to white supremacy, whose members describe themselves as Western chauvinists. For those unable to afford an attorney, the government is assigning attorneys from the Public Defender's Office paid for by U.S. taxpayers. And again, that was written by Lee Hazer of Council Bluffs. This next one is written by Ken Lane of Council Bluffs. He writes, "To be considered woke, you have to be aware of and actively attentive to important facts and issues, especially issues of racial and social justice. I disagree vehemently. It's really just groupthink being practiced. In actuality, being woke requires you to be susceptible to being altered or controlled by ideological forces or influences. Being malleable is paramount. It also necessitates disregarding common sense in favor of following teachings of people with a diabolical and ideological mindset. Many represent institutions or subversive groups. Their motive is to urge acceptance or abandonment of an idea or course of action. Erasing the great American experiment is a given. Debasing the U.S. military, the police, and all faiths except Islam, and of course the American flag." And that again was written by Ken Lane. "City to plan Disney night at River's Edge Park. Some Council Bluffs Parks and Recreation will hold Disney night featuring the movie 101 Dalmatians at Tom Hannafin River's Edge Park on May 29th. The festivities begin at 7 p.m. and include an appearance from the real Cruella de Vil Dalmatian face painting and a live broadcast from Channel 94.1. Taste of Heaven Mobile Restaurant and Blue Penguin Shaved Ice will be on site with food and drink available for purchase. A screening of 101 Dalmatians, the 1961 Disney Animation Classic, will begin at 9 p.m. There is no admission cost to attend. All activities will occur on the east side of the park near the amphitheater steps. Ample parking is available in the parking garage located on River's Edge Parkway. For details and updates, check out the city's page on Facebook." Nebraska Public Media is the new name of Nebraska Educational Telecommunications. That rebranding, which includes a fully revamped website along with new graphics, logo, and on-air designations, was triggered by the need to reflect the production of the state's nonprofit media organization and to clear up confusion created by the NET designation, said Nebraska Public Media General Manager Mark Lennard. When I came here 8 years ago, there was a lot of confusion over the name, Lennard said. It had been NETV, NETC, and NET. Then you'd go out to the state fair, and people thought we were NTV, that group of stations. There's NCN. There's an awful lot of media companies with the N in this state. The rebranding also reflects the change in the network since the first television public station, Lincoln's KUON, signed on in 1954. 11 years later, KLNE signed on as the first station in what became the 9-station statewide Nebraska Educational Television Network. In 1990, the Nebraska Public Radio Network, made up of 15 transmitters across the state, went in the air. In 2005, the television and radio networks were joined under the Nebraska Educational Telecommunications brand, where websites, apps, digital media, and podcasts have become part of the media mixture. The rebranding process took a couple of years and was, importantly, driven by a survey of NET audience members that gauged reactions to the existing brand and the proposed new name. Predictably, our long-term audience were the ones for whom NET had the most resonance, Leonard said, but Nebraska Public Media resonated just as strongly with them. For the new audience, Nebraska Public Media was by far the one that resonated the most. Many of them thought we were an internet company. As the process unfolded, there was some consternation expressed by audience members and former staff that educational had been dropped. The word educational is implied in so many of the things we do, it doesn't need to be stated in the name, Lennard said. It's there by action. The name change doesn't represent any reduction in our educational commitment. That commitment can be found in the 240 hours of educational programming Nebraska Public Media offers each week. The switch to Nebraska Public Media is coming as the nonprofit organization emerges from the COVID-19 pandemic, which saw it face some financial changes but increase its local programming. Our underwriting was off, which was true for all public media, Lennar said. The good news is our members came through. And we had our best year ever. We're now at an all-time high in the number of members. We never cut back on services, never did any staff reductions, he said. We pushed through and did more programming than we had planned in the past year, responding to the pandemic and covering the election. In fact, NET was one of the first, if not the first, media organization in the country to present a live sporting event outside of a protective bubble during the pandemic, when it broadcast the high school football Shrine Bowl from Kearney last June. Going forward, Nebraska Public Media will also serve as an accurate brand that can encompass new media offerings that are now under development. Let's turn now to some sports stories. Wait ends for LC grad Shudak. An ornery crosswind or an aggressive opponent isn't the biggest concern patient Iowa kicker Caleb Shudak is dealing with these days. The biggest challenge for the Hawkeye's 6-year senior and first-year starting place worker faces is figuring out how to put the student part of student-athlete in place before the fall semester begins. Academics aren't an issue. Shudak has been on the dean's list and president's list and is a 4-time academic All-Big Ten selection during his time at Iowa. It's figuring out what avenue to pursue next that he's putting some thought to right now. I've had a lot of schooling, Shudak said. He earned his undergraduate degree in civil and environmental engineering a year ago, and this week will complete work on a master's degree. Technically, right now, I'm an undecided undergrad for the fall, Shudak said. I've got to figure out what to do, how to fill my scheduling. Shudak also has to prepare for something he has waited 6 years for, an opportunity to be the Hawkeyes' place kicker. A 5-year understudy to Keith Duncan and Miguel Recinos, the 2016 walk-on from Council Bluffs, Lewis Central, is finally positioned to step up into a starting role. Given the opportunity to have an additional year of eligibility because of how the COVID-19 pandemic impacted the 2020 season, Chaudette jumped at the chance after Duncan chose to call it a Hawkeye career. You put in all those years of work. It's one of those things where you have this opportunity right now. It's there now, so why not take it, Chaudette said. It's not going to hurt anything doing it. I have great friends here in Iowa. The coaches are amazing. It was kind of a no-brainer. Chaudette wasn't alone. Starting long snapper Austin Spiewak also was among players who walked on at Iowa. After handling all deep snaps for the first time in 2020, he chose to return for an additional season as well. He also happens to be Chaudette's roommate. A family affair in Glenwood. The April 22nd Council Bluffs Girls Track Invitational proved to be equal parts fulfilling and historical for Glenwood. The Rams took top honors in the 7-team invite with 158 team points, but one event in particular with a family flavor stood out for Glenwood. The Rams won the 1600-meter relay using a quartet from the same family. Sisters Emma, Abby, and Lauren Hughes and cousin Kate Hughes crossed with a winning time of 4 minutes, 21.43 seconds, a season best. To have siblings and or family members compete on the same team, especially in track, isn't atypical. But to have 3 siblings, Emma a senior, Abby a junior, and Lauren a freshman, along with Kate who was a sophomore, doesn't happen often. A coach's dream is an athlete who works hard, has talent, and that's exactly how I would describe those girls, Glenwood girls track coach Katie Larson said. Obviously, they're pretty talented to begin with, but they are so good about taking coaching. They want to learn about race strategy. They keep up on quick stats. When you start off with such a great base like they have, we're able to build off of that. Just being coachable and having that talent is special. That talent is used in a multitude of events. Emma competes in the 1500, 3000, 400, and 800. Abby does the 400, 400 hurdles, the 800 relay, the 800 medley relay, and 400 shuttle hurdle relay. Lauren specializes in the 1500, 3000, 1600 relay, and 3200 relay, and Kate competes in the 400 hurdles, 1600 medley relay, shuttle hurdle relay, and sprint relay. The eldest, Hughes, Emma, has made a name for herself across a multitude of sports in her time as a Glenwood athlete. In addition to track, she has competed in swimming, cross country, and basketball. She's enjoyed a decorated career as a prep athlete, and she admits competing with her sisters and cousin in a relay is among her favorite memories over that time. It's really cool, she said. At the beginning of the season, Kate wasn't sure if she should go out for track or tennis. Me, Abby, and Lauren did a lot of convincing and got her out. All season, I think it was at the first practice, we went up to Coach Larson and were like, one time throughout the season, we need to do an all-Hughes relay. She let us do it, and it was a lot of fun. Lauren started it, going out with a great lead, and having Abby as an anchor has been really strong. Making the Hughes 2021 performance even more impressive is a lack of overall prep running experience. Many of them have, due to the cancellation of sports last spring amid the COVID-19 pandemic. MLX competed on Glenwood's 2019 Class 3A state championship team as a sophomore. Abby was a freshman that year, and Lauren and Kate had yet to compete at the prep level. We lost a lot of seniors, Abby said. Now I'm an upperclassman along with my great teammates. We all work together. Now back in action. With spring sports in full swing, Abby is taking full advantage with an impressive season. As of Thursday, she was 5th in Class 3A in the 400 hurdles, with a time of 1:07.17. She has high goals in the event. I would like to place at state in the 400 hurdles this year, and I want to have fun with it, she said. Emma is also turning heads with her events. She is currently 6th in 3A in the 1500 with a time of 4:56.11 and 7th in the 3000 with a time of 10:55.70. Lauren has had some great models in her sisters. She shares some of the same events as Emma, and she'll take any advice she can to get to improve her techniques and times. "She's always helping me to know what pace I should run," Lauren said. "She's always giving me pointers before my races. We run a lot of the same events, and she's always there for me. She just helps me stay prepared and calm. She's had a blast debuting on the prep track with her family by her side. It's so fun. They're so helpful with everything I do," Lauren said. "It makes me feel less pressured. They help me through all my training, and they're always there cheering me on. It's just awesome." Larson is happy to see not only the Hughes family, but also the rest of the team thrive on the oval. She and the Rams count every practice and every meet as a blessing after the events of last year. "It's not just about low times and qualifying for state events. It's about enjoying competition among teammates. We're just happy to be back on the track," Larson said. "I think not having a season last year kind of made this year more exciting than ever. It's refreshing to get to compete again. We're able to kind of start new this year. We've had a lot of success in the past, but we've started fresh. We've got girls with no high school running experience that have stepped up. We've brought with us our culture and climate, which is very positive and team-oriented. We've made it a goal to do the best we can and score when we can. We're looking forward to potentially working toward that conference championship." Well, everybody, we have made it. That does it for today's reading of the Council Bluffs Nonpareil for Monday, May 24th, 2021. I'm your volunteer reader, Amy B. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.